Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Panyaza Lesufi's big bet: can Gauteng deliver on jobs? Tractors tell the tale, farm sales point to rising confidence. From light switches to lifestyle, smart homes are transforming living in South Africa, and a maths meltdown, the education crisis that is robbing children of their future. It's Wednesday, the 10th of September. Now, the province of Gauteng continues to power South Africa's economy, growing at more than twice the national average, and if my numbers are correct, it contributes just over half of the country's GDP growth. Earlier this year, the province also securing investment pledges worth something in the region of 300 billion rand, exceeding its own targets. All well and good, but the picture, I would suggest, is not without shadows. Unemployment sits at around 33.7%. Millions of people remain locked out of opportunity. So let's talk a little more about that. I'm in conversation with the Premier of the province, Panyaza Lesufi. I want to talk a little about job creation and entrepreneurship. So, Premier, the growth numbers are encouraging, but unemployment at almost 34%. How much of those figures actually change daily life for residents?
Well, they do, for good and worse, unfortunately, purely because we are the melting pot of the country. Everything gets grinded here. And I always said, when the president indicated his willingness to increase the growth or the GDP growth in our country, say by 1% or 1.5%, it means that we need to do that as a province, because we are the province that is contributing almost half, as you said in our intro, of this growth. So if you take these two into consideration, the growth figures and the unemployment figures, you can see it's a melting pot and the price of being a melting pot of a country. But we are indeed excited that at least we continue to be the economic growth point of the country. But unfortunately, by doing that, we attract people from all over the province and the continent, and in some instances, other countries outside the continent who come here purely because they can see the benefits of being in our province. And that on its own creates lots of things, from housing to transport challenges and many challenges that we're facing as a country, as a province. But we are determined to play our role, and we're determined to be a good contributor to the economic growth of our country.
Investment pledges of over 300 billion does sound impressive, but I wonder how many of those commitments have actually materialized or will materialize into bricks, mortar and jobs.
I was excited that almost 2 months ago, together with the president, the pledges that was made by BMW to open a new highly technology advanced plant was successful. That's almost 5 billion. And it has moved from being a pledge to a practical solution. We are also having two plants that have been opened. We're just waiting for municipal go-aheads in terms of the steel factory, as well as another factory that is wants to bring the energy drinks that we have. So we really believe that these pledges that were made are indeed starting to translate to be investment that will create jobs. We've put up a team that supports them in terms of their needs, either in terms of land authorization or approvals with municipalities, so that we can speed up these things. So we are quite correct. I mean, our target was 300 billion, because before we made a public announcement about our target, we interact with the said individual firms that comes to our area. I mean, as I'm speaking to you now, we had advanced discussion with Cherry, that is standing by to take up a plant that will be left unattended by a certain motor vehicle international company that wants to leave our province. So we engage these institutions and say, here are opportunities, Can you join us? I've just returned from an international trip in China, the province of Hunan. They're looking for our agricultural products, and they've indicated that all the necessary tariff charges will be waived. And I mean, that's a 66 million population that is looking for either nuts, avocado, and all other related agricultural products. So to us, it's another market that we want to explore. The Saudis were with us as well. Saudi Arabia had an interest on some of our infrastructure. They want to build this infrastructure on their own, and we can agree on terms of repayment. It's something that we have an appetite. We want to check with our treasury team if it's something that we can commit our province. So there are these opportunities that we think the pledges that we made can be translated to actual investment that can create jobs and opportunities.
Premier, let me pivot back to the comment you made about people seeking opportunities from other parts of South Africa and other parts of the continent, all well and good. We also know that foreign-owned small businesses dominate often retail and services in many townships. How do you empower local entrepreneurs without creating resentment or even xenophobia, which we have seen in the province in the past?
Indeed. Is to ensure that the financing mechanisms are well oiled and also ensure that legislation supports small businesses. We don't have to pile them with unnecessary paperwork and unnecessary processes. If a family-owned business or a SMME have identified an opportunity, we need to ask ourselves, how best do we support them? And that's the energy and the area that I've been asking our teams to ensure that they provide that kind of support. Because if you do that, in most countries, it's family-owned businesses that are creating jobs, that are creating opportunities. But our local government, unfortunately, it's lacking behind. They've got their own challenges. I know we are sitting with a portfolio of many institutions or companies that either want a piece of land or they want to start an initiative, but local authorities are taking time in saying yay or nay. But these people have to continue to service either their loans and other investments. So it's a collective support that we need to provide as government to ensure that we shortened the period of authorization and we shortened the period of giving people the go-ahead to start their businesses.
But paperwork does remain the problem, as you've said, and entrepreneurs continue to cite finance as the biggest barrier. How do you ensure that youth and township businesses then are not shut out by not only the paperwork, but also collateral and credit hurdles? Because unless you can get that right, we just continue in a phase of stagnation.
I always argue, Jeremy, that the best mechanism is to learn from those that have gone through the same pain, you know. And I would call upon institutions that have gone through the same difficulties to be mentors of people that want to enter the space, especially in the townships. We've just passed last year a law called the Township Economic Development Act. We are refining it in terms of strengthening the financing component of it. And we're also pulling skills that we need in the townships, that we think that those are the skills that can unleash economic performance, especially in the artisan industry, those that are bricklayers, welders. We feel that as part of our job creation processes, that's where we need to invest our resources and our energy to then retrain or redevelop their skills so that they can be relevant. So, but the biggest opportunity is to learn from those that have gone through and ask those people to come and plant back to those communities and say, I did it because I did X, Y, Z. I think that will assist us to resolve some of the challenges that are faced by small businesses.
Just a last question then. You've set bold ambitions. What is success going to look like in a couple of years' time? Is it fewer jobless queues? Is it more thriving small businesses? What's going to move the needle here?
There are four areas. One, be merciless on lawlessness and illegal initiatives. It can be selling of illegal cigarettes, opening of illegal liquor stores and other things, or people putting up informal settlements that are not recognized. If you don't do that, you are encouraging people to do things that are going to make the economy very difficult. The second area, which we've already embraced, is to fight crime. There's no one that will come here if they feel they're not safe. And there's no one that will come to a province if they feel their families are not safe or they can't allow their children to grow in our province. So the mere fact that we've reduced crime with 7.6, which is still too high, but at least we've moved the needle, to me it's a sign that we need to work on. The third area is governance. If government systems are not well oiled to accommodate new ideas, to accommodate new growth points in terms of infrastructure growth, we did well when we demolished or removed the e-tolls. That allowed us to for Sanral to go on the market so that they can expand their roads. They could not do that because they were trapped in that big debt. Now that we paid it, it's resolved, it's removed. You have seen in the last months or so, Sanral has gone onto the market to raise some funds so that we can, because that's what we need, infrastructure to be unblocked, especially road infrastructure. We are also investing on rail with Limpopo. We met with the Minister of Transport, both as myself and the MEC, because rail is the new area of huge benefits that can create the necessary job opportunities. So those are the four areas that we think, if we concentrate and work very well, we'll see an uptake of opportunities in our province, and we'll see the economy starting to perform. But if you can't get a crime situation in our province, that's a major backlog. I've been invited by many institutions across the globe. When you go there, they show me the statistics of crime in our country. And they will tell me, I mean, there is a war in Ukraine, but these numbers in our own province are insane. How Premier are going to resolve that? So we have to work hard to eliminate this lawlessness and crime situation in our province, because if you don't do that, no one would like to come and invest in our province.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, here's some good news. Tractor sales are surging, with 700 units sold in August. That is 22% higher than the same month last year. And year-to-date, sales are up almost 25%, pointing to a strong confidence in the farming sector. Now, at the same time, combine harvester sales are holding steady, but forecasts suggest further growth ahead. So this is all good news, as I say. Let's discuss what this means as far as farming sentiment is concerned and the broader economy. And in that respect, I'm joined by Vili Human, who's chair of the South African Agricultural Machinery Association. Vili, a very warm welcome to you. 700 tractors sold in a month. What's driving the surge?
Looking at these figures, one has to look a little bit further. I think from 2023. Sorry, the figures against 2024 looks quite right. August sales was from 2024 was around about 572. And yeah, up until 2005 for August, it was 700. But if we look at 2023, the sales figures were around about the same as 2025. We had 697 in 2023. To be realistic, I don't think it's necessarily that much of a growth. It's more to say a recovery of the market. Now, I'm saying that because if everyone can remember that we had a good season in 2023 with great rains and great harvests. And then we were struck by a severe drought in February 2024. And that actually lasted that entire year up until the end of December 2024. And then after that, it was followed by great rains up until, I think, May, round about 2025. So yeah, we had a terrible year actually in 2024 with that drought, with a lot of debt on the farmers. So if I'm comparing it overall against last year, it's great, but yeah, I think it's more a recovery than actual growth in the market.
I understand you when you say it's a recovery. As I also mentioned, year-to-date sales are 23% higher. I guess that begs the question, going forward then, do you think the momentum is now sustainable, or are you always going to be susceptible to kind of exogenous shocks?
In the agricultural area, we always look up, and it all depends on the rain and the climate. So it's difficult to estimate how the season will go. But yeah, because we had that long rainy season this year that lasted up until around about May month, a lot of the guys couldn't get in the field to harvest. It was just too wet. And that extended the harvesting period, which means a lot of the guys only harvested now the past month. And that also shortens this next period to prepare the fields before the next planting season. So obviously, yeah, to get everything ready,
the farmers are forced to look at doing stuff more effective and quicker and better. And yeah, that's obviously investing in new equipment, wider and bigger equipment. So yeah, I think the sentiment at the end of the day, it's good because there was a good harvest this year at least. And then the guys are pushed to get the work done. So I think the sentiment is good for good tractor sales and implement sales for the coming few months.
That is good news. Favorable weather and crop conditions, as you say, do play a role. But I'm assuming because interest rates have eased slightly and are possibly more in the offing, farmers would be taking advantage of cheaper financing, surely?
Yes, definitely. That's always a problem. Finance is a big factor on any farmer. Not necessarily always the interest rates, but more the fact that getting finance for equipment. Not a lot of farmers can actually pay cash for. There are some, but not a lot of farmers can do that. But yeah, the availability of finance, I think, is more thing than necessarily the interest rates.
And Willie, for those of us not involved in the agricultural sector, maybe give us a sense of the role that new technology is playing in machinery purchases and what type of equipment is actually being bought and the advantage it brings to agribusiness.
The expansion of the humanity on Earth, going close to 9 billion people on Earth, and yeah, we need to be more productive on the land available to us. So the technology now available and where everything is aiming towards is to be more precise. And whatever you do, for example, if a farmer for plants maize, he needs to get everything from that one kernel that he puts in the soil. So he needs to know exactly how far each plant is spaced, what the pressure is on each spacing. Even going back to the machine itself, the tractor and the machine, let it operate more effective. Everything at the end of the day comes down to two things, and that is your input cost and what you get out of it, and to manage both of them. And yeah, that's only done by technology. That's being more precise, more effective, going wider, going faster. And that's what the agricultural mechanization companies are working towards.
And Willy, just a final question then. Is there a direct correlation between the investment that we're seeing in the technology that you're talking about and the impact on food security in South Africa?
No, definitely. Even if I take an example in our citrus industry or even nut industries, and some of the guys that's doing the more precise spraying with they're looking literally at each tree and getting the right amount of, let's say, chemicals on that specific tree in a complete orchard through the smart apply technology to investigate what tree needs to be nurtured and communicate that through the technology available to that specific implement. And where, let's say, in a orchard where that tree needs a little bit more, a little bit less, or more fertilizer, and that's all being done. So at the end of the day, to get everything or the best out of that specific tree, and that also applies to any other crops now, on whether it's maize, whether it's vegetables. So the technology is definitely, it's got a direct correlation with yields and what you get out of the product.
Willie Human, thank you very much indeed, Chair of the South African Agricultural Machinery Association. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, smart homes have come a long way from simply asking a voice assistant to dim the lights. Today, your fridge can anticipate when you'll open the door. Your oven can figure out what's on the menu before you've even decided. But as these appliances get smarter, what does this mean for convenience, for privacy and for the broader market in South Africa. Arthur Goldstuck from the research consultancy Worldwide Works has written on the subject and is with me now to talk about how this quiet revolution is reshaping the way that we live. So Arthur, as I've mentioned, welcome to you. A decade ago, smart homes were a novelty. What has driven the leap to appliances that, as I've also mentioned, now predict our behavior?
It's great to be chatting with you about this, Jeremy. I was at the IFA Expo in Berlin, where the big noise was about very unnoisy devices. In other words, smart devices that now control the home. And in the past, a smart home, as you mentioned, was about shouting at a voice assistant to switch off the lights. And a few years later, they moved it to a clap of the hands, then a gesture. And now the smart home decides for itself what you're going to want, which, of course, is exceptionally creepy. But that's my conclusion from having a look at what all the different manufacturers are doing there, especially the big guys, but small ones as well. So, for example, LG wants its whole suite of machines, and they don't just make TVs. They also make washing machines, fridges, dishwashers, and the like. But they want their fridges to predict your behavior, like when the fridge door is likely to be opened. And then they channel down, you could say, or tone down the energy used during the hours when you're unlikely to use the fridge. So in a way, the fridge is preempting family life. And they call this efficiency. As I've said in my column, some of us would call that surveillance. So there's that balance that you have to strike between how well these devices anticipate your needs, but also the extent to which they are watching what you're doing.
So at what point then does smart, Arthur, become intrusive? Are we trading too much privacy for convenience, maybe?
I believe we are. And a great example is the new vacuum cleaners, a robot vacuum cleaner. So there's some very cool ones. A Eufy, for example, has turned its new RoboVac into an all-in-one service. The mop pads wash themselves. The water refills itself automatically. So the vacuum cleaner decides what it's going to do when. I would like it to get involved in mediating family disputes. But in the meantime, what we're also seeing with these smart vacuum cleaners is that they also now have cameras and they can double up as security agents. Well, security alert devices anyway. But that means that they have to be on the lookout and they have to be filming or at least watching what you're doing. And if they're vacuuming in your private spaces, they clearly are putting together private data as well. So my argument is, if you're not comfortable with a vacuum cleaner that's got cameras and that can collect both dust and data, then this is not the future you want.
So how do we weigh the benefits then of the smart appliances against the risks of surveillance and hacking? It's a personal choice, I guess.
It's very much a personal choice, but it's the choice that we've been making for a few years now. The trade-off between privacy and access to these incredible devices that make our lives so much more convenient. And a great example of that is Gmail. I can't do without Gmail, but at the same time, I know that Google is potentially mining our Gmail for keywords that help them to target us with advertising.
Arthur, so let's talk about the broad concept again, smart homes. I'm wondering whether South African consumers are embracing the trend or are we still on the margins compared to the global uptake?
We're very much on the margins, although we get a wide range of these smart devices from different manufacturers. So our phones themselves are, in a way, hubs for smart homes because so much can be controlled from the homes, and it depends what you link to them. So for years now, we, for example, had Philips smart bulbs where you screw in your light bulb and it actually has a Wi-Fi connection that you can control via your smartphone. So you can, before you arrive home, you can set what lights go on in your home. You can set the temperature in your home from your phone and the like. The smart that we're talking about now is where the phone anticipates based on your past behavior. So it assumes because you get home at a certain time of night, it's going to turn up the heat or turn down the heat, or it's going to switch on certain lights and the like. What we also have seen is robot vacuum cleaners arriving in this market in a big way. We've had the expensive big name brands, and we've had cheap brands coming to the market as well. And they all have a small segment of the consumer market, but it's still very small. And you don't see it as a standard thing that people use. I don't go into homes and see robot vacuum cleaners being used at all, but I do know they are selling. So it means that it's the high end of the market, or it's the early adopters who are doing it. But the mass market, not yet a smart home.
But what I also think is important is whether local manufacturers and retailers, for that matter, are thinking about and are ready for the shift, or do you think for the foreseeable future we're going to remain dependent on imported solutions?
I think it's going to be largely imported solutions, or we're going to see some brands that are global having some kind of local assembly capability. In fact, one of the big exhibitors at IFA was Acer, who showed off their new ranges of laptops and gaming devices. But they also, the week before IFA, were at Comic-Con in Johannesburg, where they unveiled a new Google TV box, which is also part of this whole smart home environment. And this one is designed specifically for South Africa and assembled in South Africa. So it's homegrown, although it's a global brand that's doing it. And then it's expected to then be offered in other markets as well, once it's proven its success in this market. So local assembly, yes. And you certainly will see brands picking and choosing what they expect to work for them in this market.
And Arthur, just a final one. Within the developing economy that is South Africa's, I wonder whether this revolution that you've been talking to me about is going to touch every household, or do you think there's the danger, the risk of it deepening the divide between those who can afford the technology and those who simply can't?
It certainly won't touch every household, but I don't see this particular category as a divide. The divides are more in access to data and in access to computing, using AI and the like. But in terms of luxury items like these, I wouldn't call that a divide. It's rather just entrenching the privilege of those already are privileged.
Arthur Goldstuck, I will leave you to go and do some light vacuuming, and thank you so much for joining me from the research consultancy Worldwide Works. Always appreciate your insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's education crisis has far-reaching economic consequences. Dropout rates in the critical maths years, grades 8 through 10, are shutting thousands of young people out of future careers in engineering, finance, technology, and other high-demand fields. Without mathematics, the talent pipeline narrows, inequality deepens, and the consequence is the economy loses the skills it desperately needs to grow. I want to try and knit all of that together, and my guest today is James Lees, who's Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Advantage Learn, and he believes that tackling the maths bottleneck is one of the most urgent economic reforms that South Africa faces. James, a very warm welcome to you. This is such an important issue. And when you look at thousands of learners leaving school just as maths becomes decisive, the long-term costs for South Africa's economy and labor market are worrying and I guess fairly obvious.
Yes, thanks for having me, Jeremy. They are indeed. So I think for me all the work that we do here at Advantage Learn and why we're so passionate about improving our maths and science academic rates in South Africa is because they really are core feeders into sectors in our economy that drive innovation and growth. And without them, it means we are having to look over our borders to try and insource or outsource those skills, which is really sad because as an economy, we urgently need to grow. So we need those skills to be staying here and driving economic growth forward.
And James, explain to me how a failure in maths education then feeds directly into skill shortages in critical industries, like I've mentioned, mining, technology and finance. And all of those sectors are critical to the economic growth of this country.
Yes. So there's two ways that I look at that, Jeremy. The first is that, well, obviously there's the kind of formal and call it traditional education system that drives access into certain careers that are particularly based on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and maths. Like, for example, if you don't do well in your STEM at high school, then you might have the door closed to you to study at a tertiary level where you might be blocked from becoming a doctor, an engineer, an accountant, or some like degree. degree that would then lead you into those careers. So that's the kind of obvious direct line. The second is what we often overlook is that maths and science is two of the key subjects that develop thinking. And we often, as advanced learners, saying, you know, education is critical in that we have to develop thinking in our citizens to drive our economy forward. And maths and science is core and critical towards that, just as is philosophy and English literature, for argument's sake. But they're key subjects.
And James, in fact, you go on to say that mathematics in particular is what you term a gateway subject. What Yes. happens if the gateway remains closed for the majority of our learners, and particularly when it comes to the country's economic growth trajectory?
So if the gateway remains closed, we're seeing from research that it really impacts earning potential in our citizens. So, for example, we're seeing reports where up to 30% less earning potential in their careers due to not having done maths and science as a subject towards their studies. And so, yeah, so from that perspective, well, there's two things. Firstly, our citizens will not be earning as much, but then secondly, they won't have access to the opportunities to actually grow in their careers and drive our economy forward. So if it's closed and the gate is closed and you cannot become an engineer, then we're hoping that our companies and our economy still needs engineers. And where are we going to find those engineers? We're going to have to look elsewhere, which is then obviously very damaging to our economy long term.
And James Lees, it's even more than that, though, because if we don't intervene, there's also the risk of a widening inequality gap, I would suggest to you, where only small maths-educated elites participate in sectors and the rest are simply locked out. And that's no way to succeed as a country.
Absolutely. As a country and as a continent. I mean, Germany, the scary thing is by 2050, it's projected that we'll have the largest youth population, so under 18s, in the globe. And the number will probably go over 1 billion. So, and we're seeing a drop in the educator rates at the same time. So it's a big issue that we have to solve as a nation, where we can, because if we can produce the graduates that can be in those sectors, we could be a real driving force in the continent moving forward.
James, what do you say to business leaders who see education as government's problem? Why should the private sector care about fixing the maths bottleneck in particular?
Sure. I think that one's a direct one. The corporate sector's pipeline is directly as a result of the education system and its quality and efficacy. And so public-private partnerships and corporate partnerships in the space can really be a great lever for change to improve prospects for our learners and for our nation. We're seeing multiple examples of the corporates are getting involved in a very positive way. We do a lot of, for example, PPS students, and they really help us to broaden access to a wide range of students and help them prepare for their gateway subjects and their gateway assessments, where they need those results to be the best they can.
James, let's talk a little bit about your business. If I understand this correctly, you operate in effectively the supplementary space. And I wonder whether models like yours can realistically scale to support not just a few thousand, but much more than that. And at what cost?
Yes, Jeremy, thanks for asking. So we really believe that in order for us to really play a impactful role in this, we have to leverage technology in some fashion in order to be able to reach the number of learners that we need to over the next decades. And so our organization really focuses specifically on that. We focus on what we call in-curriculum and extracurriculum solutions that try to help learners prepare best for their large academic moments. Because in reality, in our education system, a lot rides on some of these moments that these students have to embark on, like their National Senior Certificate exams at the end of their grade 12 year. And so that's really where we try to differentiate as an organization. We produce technology-enabled solutions in an in-curricular and extracurricular fashion that really supports learners to try and do the best in those assessments.
James,
and we leverage technology and digital learning in a big way.
James, you raise a very important issue in this conversation about the importance of STEM subjects, and I absolutely understand that. But to what extent is artificial intelligence and its rapid growth impacting on your argument?
Oh, I think in a huge way, Jeremy, it's a good question. I think it's a very topical question. There's, I mean, we're seeing the rise of, call it a super intelligence of artificial intelligence. But the reality that, and how we see it from a pedagogical perspective in our world, is we are still human beings, hopefully, and will still exist, and human beings still need to be educated, and will still need to be productive members of society. And so the education system, as it has in the past, it's got two core deliveries it needs to deliver, and that's the first one is it needs to, and as I mentioned earlier, it needs to teach learners how to, or teach human beings how to think and improve their thinkings, and the second is to make people economically productive. We don't, from what we're reading and how what we're watching, we don't see those two going away. And so the education system will still be very, very, very important. Will AI play a huge role? Absolutely. And I think it'll be how our, as human beings, how we interact with that technology that will be what makes it very, very successful and profound. Just like we've done with devices, you know, and calculators. I mean, before calculators, we would have to do long division for days to calculate things. But we still, as human beings, have to think and have some form of arithmetic.
I wonder what happened to my calculator. James Lees, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, co-founder of Advantage Learn. You raised some very important issues here, and thank you so much for talking to me. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.